outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Well, I tell you what, I hope I've just finished my last book.
Really? You the hope industry, it's your last?
The industry is going crazy. My goodness. I get now probably 5 to 6 emails a week from people who want to promote It's Time.
Okay.
Or want to do a video trailer for it. And it's all people, they're all written like this person has read my book, deeply touched by it. But it all is kind of flattened out like AI is doing all this for them.
Oh, geez.
And they're committed to doing my book. Oh, there's 3 things now. There's book trailers. There's messing with the algorithm feeds on Amazon and Goodreads. Yep. And then the other one now they're doing is book club stuff, where I've got a 200 people in my book club. And for $500, we'll use your book and get a lot of readers. And some won't like for... And I got this one this last week, where I thought was hilarious. This national radio host wants me to be on their show talking about It's Time. I'm going, I'm intrigued by that. So I'll respond to that. And then lo and behold, you've got to pay $15 per station they're on. Not for the interview. The interview is free, but you got to help them get the thing on all these stations. What? So it's $3,000 for a 7-minute interview. And I just went,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, I don't think that's it. This is all stuff that used to not work this way. It has flopped overnight. Somebody's doing seminars on how to fleece self-published authors.
Jeez.
Man, I open maybe every morning. There's at least 2 or 3 every day of somebody that wants to help me with It's Time. And what a great book it is, and how powerful it is, and transformative. And there's no other book like it on Amazon. But they all say the same thing. And you just kind of go, where are they getting this? Somebody's got fleeceauthorcentral.com nailed down somewhere. So, and sadly, I don't know how to do a lot of that. I don't know how to tweak the algorithms. And I don't know how to, you know. And so I've wrestled with, should I do some of this? Should I not? Fortunately, last weekend, we sat down with the board that kind of walks through live stream with us. And we talked about it a little bit. And they said, you know, up till now, we've been leaving this all in Jesus' hands.
Mm.
Do we really want to go down a road of where we're trying to manipulate sales things? And the thing that sticks in my mind, and I think this is a podcast someday, probably in 2026, but it's about I'm not playing that game.
Yeah.
And I don't care what it is, family drama, whether it's playing with algorithm feeds, where they're trying to manipulate. Because by the time somebody's skilled enough to manipulate the algorithms have changed.
And
something else is going on.
New search engine optimization word is now the new buzzword. And that's what they're pushing. And it's like, gosh, like, where does it end?
That's why after they set you up, then they need a monthly fee to keep the momentum going.
Jeez.
And
stay on top of it.
I guess where I wrestle with that is, I should do something. I don't go to a publisher. I don't do that stuff. So who else is promoting my book in the world? And maybe I should do some of that. And then so many things. Even when I use the word promote, the little yuck meter does some fluttering. And then it's like, oh my goodness, I wrestled with this at a very young age. That come in, take the last place at the wedding. If God wants you moved up, he'll move you up. The master of the banquet and all. So anyway, that's where my head has been for the last month. Dealing with email and dealing with what we could do, couldn't do, what's going to be helpful, what's not. And then once people get into your, that's why it feels real spamish. Once you kind of express, well, maybe we could look into this, man, they just got a dog on a bone. Finally said to one lady, you really have to stop. I've told you, I'm not pursuing this any further. Anyway, First world problems.
Well, and honestly, I feel like too, it's in the regard of creative problems, right? Where your heart and your intent is, I want to put this content out there for people to be able to use it as hopefully a place where they can connect at a deeper level with the heart of Christ. That I want them to be able to engage in a new perspective or a new way of thinking about how God is loving them, pursuing them, opening opportunities for them to get to know him better, all of those things. And so, you know, I want people to access that. You want people to access that. And the content that you put out is really solid. But the tension between, I want this to be an access point for people, but then how do I get it into people's hands? How do I get it out there in the world? And especially in a digital age.
Plus, if everybody's doing it, you're still right back at the beginning. If God doesn't make a way for the book to get into the world, if you put it in my heart and that's what he wants done, then is he my distribution agent? Or do I have to finagle all that? Still struggling with it. Anyway, and I will continue to into the new year. I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this last episode of 2025.
That is wild to say. The last episode of 2025. When did you start this formally?
2025, January 1st, last year.
What?
When did I start what formally?
When did the God journey formally start? What year was it?
2005.
Okay. So 20 years this thing's been going. That is...
We're finishing our 21st year. We'll start our 22nd when we come back. Okay. If we come back in January. I love doing that. People panic. Wayne, you got to get doing it. Honestly, I have 8 different topics for a podcast here. So I think we'll be back unless Jesus comes again, which that's a reason to stop podcasting right there.
Yes, I would be okay with that.
Yeah, we all sit at his feet and stop messing with what we think might be true and find out what really is. Anyway, best thing you heard this week. Got one?
Yes, I do. So the best thing that I heard this week actually came from one of my students' finals, and they were presenting a project to the class, and
your students are always your quote sources these days. Your students are your children. That's it. Are you reading anything else?
I mean, I am, but for me, it's the things that I am reading, and then there's the things that my students are exploring. The revelations that they're having. And for me, it's so much more impactful to hear how they've taken content that I've put out there to them or that they've explored in alignment with some of the things that we've been doing in coursework and seeing where they take it beyond just the discussion in class or just beyond the homework assignment or, you know, those types of things. And so, man, this one just really resonated with me. It says, "When life wants to make you stronger, it sends you battles, not blessings. But you often think you are being punished. You think life is against you, but the obstacle is never the enemy. It is the invitation to more. When David was meant to become a king, he wasn't handled a throne. He was handled a giant. Because greatness is not given, it is provoked. It must be fought for. It must be awakened inside you. The mountain was never meant to crush you. It was meant to show you who you are. So next time life sends you a storm, don't curse it. Don't run from it. Bow to it, for the storm has come to crown you, dear child of the king."
Wow. So look forward to disaster coming your way.
No, I'm not looking forward to disaster, but looking at it through a different lens. Because that I think so often, especially that first part where it was talking about how we face these life struggles or these life challenges. And often our prayer is like, God, what did I do wrong? Is there not enough faith in me? Like, what's going on here? We think that we're being punished for something, that because of our behavior or because of something that we did, now God is stepping in and saying, okay, I'm going to bring the pain now. And yet, I don't think that's the case. I think it is the invitations, because we live in a broken world. We live in a fallen world. But I think that God, in his incredible beauty, is able to recraft what the enemy would hope for as a challenge or as something that would undo us, as an invitation to be able to move into a greater level of intimacy and wholeheartedness. And that, to me, is very interesting.
It's beautiful if we're not assigning that to God. Like, God's, I want to make you great, so here it comes. If it's life dealing that out to us and God taking advantage of it, then I'm all in. Yeah. Because I think so many people, that's where the punishment thing comes in. They personalize it to the extent of, well, God's given me this horrible trial now, or God's testing me. That's the other thing from my religious days that I don't carry anymore with me. I don't think God's like, okay, Wayne, I think we'll give you a test today. Just see how well you're doing. Like, God doesn't already know how well I'm doing or not doing.
And I think the one place that a lot of people really get caught up in this is the story of Job. Right? Like, because it's like, okay, the devil walks into the throne room, is like, hey, what about your servant there, Job? You know, I want to see if he's actually faithful to you, Jesus. Like, does he really trust you or not? Let's put the hammer down, because it's only been blessings in his life. I don't know.
God says, great, let's do it. Go ahead.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, I think people miss the setup of that and they get too literal and then they end up with real problems with God. But the old religious God, yeah, you've got him doing stuff like that. That's what he would do.
Oh, absolutely.
But when Jesus comes, he shows us a different father. And the Jesus we see in scripture wouldn't do that in the same way. So what was used as a literary device to provoke a great conversation about suffering and pain and where is God in the midst of it gets lost on the idea that, yeah, God takes his cues from Satan. And if you're doing too well, somebody's looking to knock you off and God will cooperate with Satan to make that happen. Leads to some really bad conclusions, for sure.
Some very, very dark spaces in regards to the character and the nature of God, for sure. What about you?
Boy, I think I'm going to use this. This is from an unpublished manuscript, so it's not fair to anybody else but me. But maybe you get to share this part of it. It's written by a Serbian man who's got this book in Serbian or some kind of Eastern European language, and he's trying to look for an opportunity to put it into English. And distribute here in the States. Anyway, quote from the book is this: God is teaching me that my heart is an inexhaustible source of love. I can always find complete and unblemished love always and for everyone. It is ready to give and impart warmth to everyone who has been created by his hand. Love, that divine breath that dwells within us, is an enormous treasure and an unusual one. It is a treasure that knows no rules of trade or laws of logic and algebra. What's more, it contradicts and negates them, making them look absurd. Love is the only wealth that cannot be depleted, no matter how much we give away. It is the perfect treasure, the one that comes back to us when we give it away and multiplies and increases when we share it. With love like this and in such measure, we can embrace the entire world.
Whoa. Okay.
What wow. I love about that is you can't read that and go, okay, I've got to find my way to that kind of love. I've got to call out of my own being love that's inexhaustible. And we all go, it's not possible.
That's exhausting.
The love of God flowing through you, then you don't have to apportion it out saying, oh, if I give too much here, I won't have enough over there. And I love the idea of whatever is given is multiplied back. It's this flow of love that comes from the heart of the Father through conduits and vessels of his glory on the earth, and that is, it can flow forever. It can just keep being poured out, and I don't have to restrain. It doesn't mean you can do everything you think to do. It doesn't mean that. You know, we run into that with some of our friends in Kenya who think they've got to take care of every conceivable need within 500 miles of where they live, and we finally just say, we can't do this. The disasters happening even in Kenya because of weather and climate change and all that kind of stuff. They can't keep up with it. We can't keep up with it. It doesn't mean that, but love, the warmth, the kindness, the giving out. It's if it's coming from you, you'll wear out. If it's flowing through you, and this what I love about the quote is, this is not pretend love. This is not trying to be loving for God, because you will be crashed on the bed of exhaustion within a week or two. This is about learning how that love flows through me.
That was actually my question as you were reading that, is this a good litmus test for when we have moved out of being a doorway or an access point to the world for God's unlimited love versus us moving out of some place of our own need, our own insecurity, our own performance, our own desire, and it not coming from that authentic kingdom love? That was the thought that came through. Because when you said inexhaustible, I was like, yeah, I love that. And I agree with that, because when it's flowing from kingdom, then absolutely. But when it's not, when it's flowing from my own self-effort or my need to be accepted, it gets really exhausting really fast.
It does. And that would be a good indication of when I find myself exhausted with loving. Now, what do I do with that? Do I double down and try harder because I've got to do it for God? Because Wayne said it was inexhaustible, which doesn't mean I'm quoting some Serbian guy. Okay. It's not me. But, or do I say, okay, God, I haven't found that flow, or I've lost touch with that flow because I'm trying to do in my own energy what you do so well if we just live inside that unforced rhythms of grace reality. And that'd be a good indication. It's not just like, no, crud, I've been doing it because I'm exhausted, so I've been doing it in my own strength. It wouldn't be go pout somewhere. It would be, okay, I need to learn something about love. Jesus, would you teach me? And get in that flow of love, because I find that that's really true. I remember the old days of trying to love in my own strength, and particularly when you're paid to love as a official clergy member or whatever, then it's just, I was exhausted all the time. It's just worn out.
Yeah.
Now, and I deal with a much larger audience. Everybody has access to me now. And I just find, man, loving that person, loving that person, loving that person. And that with Jesus walking with, there's time for rest. You don't have to just keep loving people 24/7, being out on the street trying to find somebody to love next. Watch who God brings by you. Watch the inexhaustible source he's put inside you to offer warmth and tenderness to every life who crosses your path. I love that.
I do too. I think about how easily that could get twisted by the religious performance space.
Right? Yeah, like, let's not do that.
Okay.
No, I mean, I know. Don't do it on this podcast, but yeah, I hear what you're saying.
And I think even like when it goes into that, forgive me if I don't know if we want to go here or not, but the idea of the love badge, the religious performance love badge of look who I'm loving, and I am, because I'm loving this audience or these people, or I'm working with these people, then I am getting more brownie points in the religious performance environment.
Yeah. This is not how you'd want to apply that for sure. Cause you will end up exhausted.
Yeah.
That's what I hear when I tell people loving on somebody, that phrase, which is very popular in religious life now, that to me sounds like that project.
Yeah.
I'm loving on. I wouldn't say it to Sarah about Sarah. I wouldn't say it about my kids. I wouldn't say it about people in my life. I'm not loving on them. I love them. Yeah. And that's a very different reality. Loving on someone seems to make them a bit of a project. And I realize it can just be bad language that soaks into the way we talk, but I'm all for one for backing out of bad language. You don't love on people. You either love them or you don't. You either have affection for them or you don't. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, find it where you can find it, in him, not try and call it from the deeper recesses of my own soul. I love the flow of love, the river of love that comes from the heart of the Father flows. This is all part of some of this is in the book that we just finished recently that we're trying to figure out how best to position in the marketplace these days. So anyway, the holiday season's coming. This is when everybody kind of gets fixated on what do I want for Christmas and
Christmas
bonuses and what does someone else get? I thought this article, I sent it to you because I thought it was really interesting. It was the title of it was $100,000 new car won't make you happy. Here's what will say experts on the psychology of money. And man, it starts out with nothing is desired as much as the thing you want but can't have.
Yes.
That's a provocative statement, shall we say?
It is a provocative statement. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And then goes on to talk about how we kind of set how the human whatever works in terms of what it wants that it can't have and what it tries to find on its own. In The Art of Spending Money, a book that the article refers to, it says, hardly matters what that something here is. A glass of water to a thirsty person is more valuable than a private jet to a billionaire who has two others. This all makes sense when you understand what your brain wants, and you'll notice it more during the holidays. By and large, your brain doesn't want nice cars or big home. It wants dopamine. That's it. The molecule of more. Dopamine is the chemical of desire that always asks for more. More stuff, more stimulation, more surprises. In pursuit of these things, it is undeterred by emotion, fear, or morality. From dopamine's point of view, it is not the having that matters. It's the getting something, anything that's new.
And I think that's one of the really intriguing parts about this is the new element, right? Because that's why, for example, when the programmers went into social media and they started looking at, okay, how do we create and tap into this need for the dopamine hit? How do we coordinate that or integrate that into our programming system? What does that look like? And when you look at it, it's all, whenever I put out a new post, how many new likes am I going to get? How many new comments am I going to get? How many new follower requests am I going to generate because of that new post or because of that new picture or that new video that I've posted up? And it just creates this vicious cycle because then you're on this need to always be creating something new. And this is what is really intriguing to me, especially when I think about like the content creators or the people that I call them the Instagram ready families that are constantly posting these videos of what their family is doing or the vacations that they're on or the crafts that they're making, and their kids, there's no stains on their clothes. The lighting is just perfect. Everything is set up just right. And yet, man, watching those individuals' lives from behind the camera and watching how much of that they're having to try to generate and create and be able to put out there, because they're trying to put this brand, they're trying to create this image, and yet they're always having to generate something new. I've got to maintain this idea. I've got to maintain the look. I've got to make it better. I've got to make it bigger. I've got to create this imagery that more people are going to desire. And it's this never-ending feedback loop that they're constantly seeking.
And it's not just the content creators. It's also the content absorbers, because the doom scrolling thing, it just, I'm looking for something new along the same lines. Something just gives that part of me some feeling of hit. And it really is amazing. As I read this article, I was thinking so many times about my life, particularly as a child and then growing up as a young man. You want something really bad. You want this new car, or I remember as a teenager, I wanted to get a guitar, man. I was going to be a guitar guy. Even though I'm not a music guy, I was going to try and be a guitar guy. And so I saved up my money, went down, got this guitar. So happy, so excited. And then within 2 or 3 weeks, it's just a guitar sitting in the corner of the room. And you may play it now and then, but all the excitement of getting it is lost to having it.
Yeah.
I remember my son at one point, he was probably 10 or 12. He wanted this coat. It was a 49er coat. We were in San Francisco. And he had to have it. And I'm a Green Bay guy, so I don't want to get him a 49er coat. I remember him turning to me and said, "Dad, if you let me get this," and he was wanting to spend money he had saved and he was going to earn the rest of it. "If you let me get this, I will never want anything again for as long as I live." As an adult, I could see the humor in that. I thought it was hilarious. But at the same time, I could remember having those feelings about so many things, and it never worked. It never, once having the thing you desire, it doesn't sustain. So then and that's what the article talked about. Then you got to get something else that you desire, something new. Got to find that new. And it's the getting it that brings joy, not the having it. If we could really understand that, that would change so much about what we buy or what we do or the vacation we want. Because once we have it, we lose the capacity to enjoy it.
The article also explores the intensity of the gap between what you have and your appreciation for what you have and the intensity of the things that you want. So how big is the gap between what I currently have and I'm currently enjoying versus the things that I've set my sights on? The hard part is that we live in a culture that is based on capitalism. It's based on people getting ahead because they're desiring this big thing that's out there ahead of them. And then as soon as they achieve that, now I've got to go find the next really, really big thing. And that's the whole aspiration of our society, is keep going, keep going, keep building, keep creating, keep getting bigger, keep going after what you want. And yet the article talks about being able to be content and at rest, largely because you're not, the desire for this thing way out there isn't there. It's no, I'm able to be desire the things that I currently have, be present with the things that I currently have. There's not this huge gap between what I want and what I currently have, and how you can actually be in a space of gratitude, even if you're in quote unquote financial poverty, versus the people who have these substantial access to means and resources, and yet this insatiable desire for the next thing, the next relationship, the next deal, the next ... fill in the blank.
Yeah, the reality is we cannot buy our way to happiness, but most people think we can.
Yeah.
Underlying bias, though, just get the right thing and just get this financial pressure off my life, I'll really be happy, and it doesn't last. One of the things is, quote from the article, "To be content with what you have is the deepest way to enjoy the house you've purchased, the clothes you wear, the vacations you take." To be content with what you have, which sounds really biblical. But in an age when you talk about being content, when everything's driven by, I mean, the advertising we're bombarded with multiple times per day is, you can have more and you can have better. And we're interested in you spending your money with us to tickle that dopamine hit. And then we don't care that you really don't enjoy it as much as you thought it would, because that'll just increase your desire for something more. This whole idea that Paul talked about, being content with what you have, being content, whether you have a lot, whether you have a little, that the contentment doesn't come from things. It comes from deeper realities. That card that I love, there's a card that goes around, a quote a long time ago, the most important things in life aren't things. It's always people. It's always the relationships you have. And that doesn't hinge on how much money you make. That doesn't hinge on what possessions you have. And learning contentment with what God's already given you is the quickest way to happiness, not trying to get the next big thing.
That combination of contentment, and even I would say beyond that, gratitude of the rhythm of life, of saying, I'm so grateful for what I currently have, and being thankful for the blessings that we have, or the resources and the relationships that we have in our life. And so when I was in my graduate work, that was a really trendy space that was moving into the mental health world, is this attitude or the positioning of gratitude. So that having these reflections of thankfulness and gratitude, and how that influences your mental space, how that influences your anxiety levels, depression, all these different things. I love the idea or the intent behind making it a rhythm of gratitude, of contentment, of saying, man, Lord, I can't believe the beauty of the things that I have right now. And I did a journal reflection exercise with some students, and I said, okay, I want you to write down 150 things that you're grateful for. And so when you first start that out, like, you're grateful for, you know, you're writing down these like things and these items that you're grateful for, and you get to about 25 or 30, and then all of a sudden all that surface level stuff disappears. And now you have to actually start getting specific about, what are the small things that I don't really even think about that I need to turn my focus towards and say, man, it's incredible that I can get up and I can walk without pain, or that injury that I had, it's healed, or I got a great meal today and I'm not starving. Or, I mean, just those things, posturing and realigning our heart with this space of gratitude. And it's, I mean, honestly, this is a hard one for me that God and I are still working through. I definitely can find or recognize when I'm stressed or tired, and I'm really like looking for, okay, how do I get more motivation? That's when that desire for something new, whether it's purchasing something new or going trying something new, versus holding the course, staying consistent, stay disciplined, stay in this, remain in this, even though it's not as flashy, even though it's not as bright shining lights or whatever it might be, stay in this, because there's value in the consistency. There's value in holding the course, in remaining in that rhythm. And man, that is a battle, an ongoing conversation that God and I have on the regular right now.
Yeah, and to stop chasing the dopamine hit.
Yes.
Stop playing that game, which the world wants you to play every day, all day, whether it's scrolling content, buying a product, seeing something flashy, beautiful, whatever, and you gotta have it. I read this article in the midst of finalizing the book Toby and I are working on, Just Love. Mm. Toward the very end of it, as he's talking about, how does love fulfill the law? If that's the goal of God, is that love fulfills it. This is a statement that I find incredibly provocative. Love fulfills the law because it fills us. Mm. And he gets there with the James scripture, that all the conflict and struggle and war in the world has because I don't have what I want. You have what I want. So I'm going to come and take it from you. See Putin in Ukraine there. Or see the person who's going into debt to buy a car to impress their neighbors. I mean, you could see it all over. I don't have what I want, so I'm going to strife. All strife, James says, comes from that wanting and not having, the very thing this article is talking about. Yeah. And Toby's point that love fills us. So now I'm not having to take from you, exploit you, hurt you in some way to get what I want, because I'm full. Love fulfills the law because it fills us. And then this statement, and I'm quoting from a book you can't read yet, sorry. The temptation in the garden was extremely simple. What you need is outside of your reach, and you need to do something to get it. When Eve looked at the tree and saw that it could give her food and wisdom beyond what God had allotted, she desired it. The devil did not create some dirty desire inside of Eve. He directed her inborn passion for God to something outside of God.
Oh, that's so good. Man, just even the idea that as God's love continues to move in us and fill us up, and I'm thinking about even like literally the conversation that I was having with those wrestlers about wholehearted identity versus fear-based identity. When I'm living in the rest of the love of Christ and my identity as his beloved, those desires, those needs, they're not there. They're not present. They may still be around me, but they don't have the allure, the temptation, the pull, the draw, the fangs that they do when I'm tired and exhausted and I'm not looking for, when I'm not feeling filled, when I am feeling depleted, when I'm feeling run down, when I'm feeling like somebody has taken a shotgun to my tank and is completely running all the water out of it. Man, that's when it's like, okay, desperation. How do I fill this tank? How do I plug the holes? How do I find something that is going to at least do a little bit of filling back up versus, God, what does it look like for your love to seal these spaces in my heart? Because they're not these cracks, these holes in my cistern are not authored by you. They're authored by my own insecurities, my own fear, my own lack of knowing who you are and what your love is for me. I love that idea.
Yeah. And to think the desire, maybe why this dopamine thing doesn't work. The desire God created in us was for him.
Yes.
That we're trying to fill that with a guitar, a new car, a better house. And maybe that's why the dopamine hit never lasts long. It's the getting, and the getting doesn't fill the hole. So after a few days, I mean, it does for a while, certainly does. Yeah. I get something new. I'm excited. I'm showing my friends. I'm doing whatever. And then it kind of passes. And then I've got to look for something else. That God put a desire in us for him. And it won't be satisfied by anything else. But if we don't know that and not finding our fullness in him, and that this, because all these things, this article and working on this chapter that Toby had primarily written, being able to come back to that at the same time and go, okay, wherever I sense discontent rising in my heart in the past 3 weeks, I've done this. I've just stopped and said, I want my fullness to be in you. I want my fullness to be in you, not in that thing, not in that person treating me a certain way, not in respect from somebody who's not giving me that respect right now. Not those things. I'm going to find my fullness in you so that I can live in the world not having to get something. I can live in the world what Toby calls, or we've called in the book, the justness of love. And he says, the justness of love is not an act of the will. It is an overflow of love and life. If the law could give life, then justice would have been by the law, Paul wrote in Galatians 3:21. The justice of God can only flow from the life of God. And that's what got cut off in the fall, that our life wouldn't be found in him. It would be found in some fruit off a tree, in the knowledge of good and evil, in something other than him. And that's kind of human history from then on, is the seeking of life apart from God, instead of finding that fullness in him, not as some abstract, I've got to pretend to be full because I'm a good Christian. It's not that. I find when I lean away from the discontent, just in the smallest little stage of it kind of provoking my heart, particularly people ask me, what do you want for Christmas? I don't really want anything. How well, I played my second round of golf. I played 18 holes this last week and survived.
Nice.
So yeah, so I'm coming back from back surgery, whatever. And it was fun. It was fun to be with people. But when discontent sets in, I'm just going, okay, I want my fullness to be in you. Mm. The desire to be in God, not the desire to be for my life to work out well, for everything to, for my life to be conflict-free today. Someone said to me this week, I loved it, your comfort is less important to God than his purpose. Most of us kind of got thinking it was the other way around. Now you really want my comfort, and that'll be your purpose, is to make me comfortable.
Yeah.
And then I love this. I love that the justness of love is not an act of the will. And I think the book all aims that way. It's not how to perform justice better for God. This is how to let something else fill you, that justice then flows out of you without you thinking, without you being intentional, without you fighting to somehow be just for God. It's no fullness. Love fulfills the law because it fills us. I love that statement.
I just keep coming back to the idea of what does it look like if we are being filled by his love, that if that's where we are leaning into and pressing into, especially in this, in a world that we are constantly swimming in comparison and intentional seeds of discontent, because then you can be manipulated. Then you can be controlled. Then you can be predicted. Then your behavior can come under somebody else's authority because they are offering you some counterfeit version of fulfillment. And gosh, that, when I think about how that impacts the way that I live my life, the way that we, even making goals and setting perspective, and like I was literally just in a conversation about this the other day and was wrestling with God on it, because I was wrestling with this idea that I'm not a finance guy. I've been interacting with some audiences where they're like finance guys and money is their focus, and that's really where the litmus test of the quality of their life is found, is by how much income am I generating. And I hate those spaces because I really struggle, especially with guys, for whatever reason. We always somehow, when I'm hanging out with a group of guys, somehow the conversation eventually lands on what's your portfolio like? What's your investments like? What does your long-term strategy look like? What does your financial wellness look like? All these spaces. And for me, I really wrestle with that because that's where the challenge of comparison comes in. That's where the discontent comes in, because it's like, I have never oriented my life around generating my finances or generating more finances. The question in my mind has always been, is this in alignment with what God's calling me to do? And then secondly, will it pay my bills? And if it does, great, perfect. That's what I need it to do. Is it going to cover the needs of my family? Is it going to cover my bills? Perfect. And yet there's always this feeling of insecurity or insufficiency whenever I get in these group conversations with guys and the content comes up about finances and making more money and being financially secure and being financially independent and all these conversations. And that's a tough one for me.
I hear you. I don't even know that I've had that conversation with a group of guys ever. I can't remember.
Really?
Talking about portfolios and money and retirement. And maybe my generation is different. We just don't talk about that, because if someone has less around you, you wouldn't want them to feel bad about that. Or if you have more, what's the arrogance of that? That's kind of distasteful. So I don't know that I've ever been in that kind of discussion, but I certainly have been in discussions about book sales and about other things where you finally cut thinking, well, maybe I should be doing more to do this and that. And it creates what they say is, I think we talked about this in a podcast a couple of years ago. You want to hang out with people who have slightly less than you do. That's where you can be really happy. If you hang out with people who have more than you do, you'll be frustrated that you can't do all, you can't go to dinner where they go to dinner. You can't afford to do the vacations they do. So you got to hang out with people just slightly less than you. So you're kind of at the top. But this is talking about something completely different, that when love fulfills me, then I'm aware, when I'm talking in a room like that, I'm not just aware of what I want to boast about so others feel bad. I'm very aware of, I want to be in a space to affirm what's happening to other people. Certainly, it's not wrong. I know people will write us saying, well, you don't think we can invest money or do it. No, it's
no.
Coming at those things from fullness is a lot better than coming at those things from emptiness. And my portfolio is what's going to make me happy. It's what's going to fulfill me. That's the difference. And that's why I'm freshly talking to God about this in my own life. Where is my fullness here so that I can live from it? And I had a very specific engagement this weekend with someone that's uncomfortable for me to be around because of how they treat me. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to come at this from fullness. I'm going to fill up before I'm going to talk to God about it. I had days to know it was going to happen. And I'm going to go in that room from fullness and be able to love. And I did. I mean, it didn't feel fakey. It felt real. It just, I don't need their respect to make my way in the world. I don't need it. I've got God's, what am I going to say? God's endorsement. That'd be the wrong word. I have God's affirmation that I'm his beloved child. Not perfect, not the best child on the planet. Just I'm one of his kids and he loves me. And I can live from that place. And it was just so easy to be in that environment this time because I made an intentional, I had an intentional desire in conversation with God about, I want to find my way to fullness here. And I used three words on a podcast a while back about when I got back from Greenville, South Carolina, about affection. And that's what people say, well, how do I find that fullness? One, find his affection. When you find his affection, then let him cultivate his presence inside you. So the affection, not just God loves me as I'm struggling through life, but let affection lead you to presence. So there's engagement with God. And when I engage him, that's where fullness comes from. It's the engagement. It's presence with me. It's insight about something I'm dealing with. It's rest in the midst of struggle when I don't have answers yet, when I'm still perplexed by what we're going to do here next. Presence sets my heart at ease. And presence, right? So affection to presence to fullness. And if we can learn how God navigates that space in our lives, then I think we can live more freely.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I even like thinking about the financial space in the conversation, there are people that I have encountered and do life with that part of them living out of who God has created them to be is generating this financial space. Like they just do it. So they do it out of joy. They don't do it out of a place of insecurity. It's just their natural passion and who God's created them to be. And I enjoy being around those people. It's not this flex of identity of I've got to hang my signpost on this, you know, I've got to hang my sign out here because that's what's going to fulfill me. And yet so often that's not the space that conversation goes. And man, it's, I don't know. And I think part of it too, for me was that was a space growing up that was also highly valued is what is your management? What is your space around finances? That's how you show, you know, that you're a good husband, that you're a good provider. I mean, that's biblical, that you need to be a very hard worker and that you are generating tons of finances for your family because that's what you're supposed to do. And man, it was just a really interesting space, but there was no wholeness out of it. It always felt like an immediate energy drain instead of an invitation to live in the love of the Father, to continue to grow in your understanding of the Beloved, and to operate out of whatever passion and skill set and drive that God has placed in your life, living from that space, because that's where you live wholeheartedly. That's where you live in his love. And man, to be able to dwell in that space, to dwell in that presence with him, that's a very fulfilling, very light space to live. That is a light yoke. That's not the heavy burden of performance or drive.
And it is. And scripture talks repeatedly about real wisdom is the treasure.
Yeah.
And we get it flopped around saying, no, the treasure is my net worth, my bank account, my whatever. No, the real treasure, which you have in spades, is the wisdom and kindness and tenderness that love shapes in a heart.
So I guess we'd say less dopamine and more fullness.
Well, that'll do it for this year. We'll skip next week. We'll see you in 2026.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.